So the question, the next question that Maharaj Nimi asked, he said, "O great sage, please explain how even a foolish materialist," and the word is someone who is, it says, "Yataitam Aishwaram Mayam," how this Aishwaram potency, this powerful potency of the Supreme Lord, this Mayam, Dushtaram, which is impassable, unsurpassable, Akritabmabhi, by those who are not controlled, Taranti, they may cross over. Anja, Stuladiya, easily, those whose intelligence is gross, or Stuladiya, dulled. And why? Due to their material attachments. So, Maharsha Idam Uchete, please tell us, O great sage, please tell us this. So this is a very important question. It is relevant because in Kali Yuga everyone's manda samanda mateo, manda abhagya, upadrutaha, everyone's consciousness is dull and branched into so many material, it's touching and attached to so many material things in Kali Yuga, so very difficult. So we'll read some of the purport here. According to Srila Sridhar Swami, Stuladiya indicates those who ignorantly identify themselves with the gross material body and who are therefore unable to analyze the subtle laws of nature by which the soul transmigrates in illusion. Srila Jiva Goswami comments that Stuladiya also indicates so-called pious persons who execute pompous religious ceremonies for material sense gratification rather than trying to prepare themselves to go back home, back to Godhead. A vision of Chakravarti Thakur, King Nimi was already an advanced devotee and therefore he's asking for the benefit of others. So here comes the answer. Almost. Accepting the roles of male and female in human society, the conditioned souls unite in sexual relationships. Thus, they constantly make material endeavors to eliminate their unhappiness and unlimitedly increase their pleasure. So that's the endeavor. This defines, really refers back to the previous section, what's going on in the material world. But one should see that they inevitably achieve exactly the opposite result. In other words, their happiness inevitably vanishes. As they grow older, their material discomfort increases. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
Yeah, all those who have noticed that, right? Anymore. We can... All those who haven't noticed yet. What should they do?
Wait.
Just be patient. We should all now, all the old people have noticed, we should write down lists of all the things that are causing us pain. And we'll read them to everyone. Wealth is a perpetual source of distress. So this is exactly the opposite of the other verse too, but this is exactly the opposite of how a hopeful materialist thinks. It is most difficult to acquire, and it is virtually death for the soul. In what sense is it death for the soul? Huh? Yeah, in what sense is death for the soul?
It facilitates sense gratification. It entangles one.
It entangles one so much in keeping it and spending it properly and fearing for its its safety and health. It entangles one so much in that. But there's actually a devotee way, a Vaishnava way to deal with wealth. And what's that?
To use in service to Krishna.
But what's the mentality?
It belongs to Krishna.
It belongs to Krishna. And Krishna has placed this under my care to use it for his pleasure. So I should use it very carefully, but it is his. And therefore, when one is caring for it, one will have a different mentality. Unfortunately, sometimes it's too different. In other words, anyway, this is Krishna's, who cares? But not like that, but because that's obviously not devotional. But once you care for it, but thinking of it as Krishna's, the body is Krishna's, one's possessions are Krishna's, one's everything that one comes in contact that a materialist will think of, put the word my in front of it, my family, my computer, that's the obvious one, my computer, thinking of it as Krishna. I remember in the old days, when the devotees, having one of Prabhupada's books was very rare, and if you look in the bookstores room every once in a while, you'll find that a devotee and you don't want other people to take it, so in the beginning, so a materialist person will write his name in it, this is the property of such and such, but the devotees would always write, in the care of. And, but now, it's somewhat different because they only have soft copies anyway. Anyway, so what satisfaction does one actually gain from his wealth? Wealth means shakti, it means power, and you turn it into sense enjoyment. And the more wealth one has, the more ability one has to manipulate the material energy for sense enjoyment. And to protect it. So that's the purpose of accumulating wealth for pleasure, and then you have to protect it. And the more you have, the more you think you can protect it. And you diversify your portfolio and on and on and on. But the question is, what satisfaction does one actually gain from this wealth? So it's the actual. Actually, there's some satisfaction, but is it real satisfaction? Or is it really the cause of distress? Similarly, how can one gain ultimate or permanent happiness from one's so-called home, children, relatives, and domestic animals, which are all maintained by one's hard-earned money? One, so he's speaking about the mentality of someone who has the mentality of a dull materialist, but he's understanding. He wants to plant this understanding and the consciousness that this isn't actually our happiness. And from what I've seen, we constantly have to be reminded of this because we can't, it's not possible for us to become absorbed in thoughts of Krishna in a favorable way and at the same time be absorbed in the opposite, the sense of enjoyment that I'm here to enjoy and to be safe and to exploit the material energy. The two are quite incompatible. So in case one may think the materialistic mind tends to think, it gets involved in plan making. The reason why I'm not satisfied and happy is because I don't have this particular material circumstance and material facility. And then the plan is always to accumulate that. And happiness is, again, just like that carrot dangling in front of our face, but we can never achieve it. I mean, when we have the hope that I can become materially happy, it doesn't die easily within a person. And one of the reasons why it doesn't die easily is because other people who have the things that we don't have, we conceive of them as happy. Because we see examples of those who we imagine are happy. And that is one of the great happinesses of a conditioned soul, to make others think that he's happy. And therefore what arises in the other's mind is envy. So that's very much the happiness of a conditioned soul, to have other people envious of them, imagining that they have the happiness that the person himself is seeking. And then just look at that, how, even though it's obviously so nasty, but also how can you be happy if everyone is envious of you? Because everyone is, if everyone is envious of you, what does it mean? What does it practically mean? Huh? You're successful. But what does it mean they're all hoping? They want you to, whatever you have, they want you to lose. And then they'll say, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that I'm so sorry that your son has just died, and I'm just so really sorry to hear about it. And the inside thought is something completely different. But how can you be happy when so many people that are surrounding you are wishing your downfall and bad things to be happy to happen to you, and therefore you have to be frightened of everyone? And being fearful is the opposite of being happy. Just that simple example of the way the material world actually works. You have a political post that you're the president and everything, and there's always your enemies who are directly trying to knock you down and make your name bad, and then there's the so-called your enemies who are in the shape of friends, and your allies who are also looking for a chance to take over and wait, and they want to be next, and etc., etc., etc. So you can't trust anyone, and how can you be happy when there's no trust? And if there's no trust, there can be no love, there can be no true relationships. So how can you be happy in that sense? One cannot find permanent. So then the next stage of desiring happiness is the pious way, is think, well, if I do perform enough piety, then when I go to heaven, Swargalok or something, then I could be happy. But that's another hope that cannot be fulfilled. One cannot find permanent happiness. This is the next text, 20. Even on the heavenly planets, which one can attain in the next life by ritualistic ceremonies and sacrifices. Even in material heaven, the living entity is disturbed by rivalry with his equals and envy of those superior to him. And since one's residence in heaven is finished with the exhaustion of pious fruit of activities, the denizens of heaven are afflicted by fear, anticipating the destruction of their heavenly life. Thus they resemble kings who, though enviously admired by ordinary citizens, are constantly harassed by enemy kings and who therefore never attain actual happiness. And if you read the history of Europe or of India, when so many kings existed, it was torture. The worst, when you read the history of what one king did to another king, and someone becomes powerful and conquers the other kings and you know, captures everyone and makes them slaves, and then you go to the Amir fort outside of Jaipur, and you know this huge fort. Why do you have such a huge fort? It's because you're afraid of everyone attacking you. And who was it built by? By the, because you don't have enough money to build such a big fort. You don't can't use your citizens for that. So you have to take over the neighboring kingdoms and get slaves and everything. They didn't pay them the minimum wage or anything like that. You know, and like the Great Wall of China. It is also known as the. Has anyone ever seen the Great Wall of China? Only Buzz Bihari. It's known as the longest graveyard in the world, because you know they just get slaves to build it, and then when they die, just throw them in the wall and just cover them over. I mean, it's horrible what happens to successful people and unsuccessful people. It's horrible. And you see a summary of the horror of it by in the Bhagavatam, in the kings that are caught by Jarasandha, he's going to sacrifice to Bhairava for his benefit, for his elevation, and they're saying we don't want to deal with this anymore. You know, we're trapped now, we're going to surrender unto you. And then when Krishna rescues them, they have prayers that are so wonderful, that really recapitulates what material life is like, because everyone is we have our little kingdoms, and that's what everyone is trying to establish. Even in our spiritual life, we try to establish our little fortresses of security, but you can't, because as soon as you do, you're fearful of others, etc. And then as soon as you're fearful, you see someone coming up, even amongst your friends, and immediately the friend is an enemy, because you don't know, he's a takeover, whatever. So, spiritual life is something completely different than heavenly security. And since one's residence in heaven is finished with the exhaustion of pious fruitive activities, the denizens of heaven are afflicted by fear, anticipating the destruction of their heavenly life. Thus they resemble kings, who though enviously admired by ordinary citizens. So the ordinary people think, boy, that looks really good. But behind the sugary sweet covering of the successful is a rough life. Can't trust anyone, because everyone smiles and is nice to you, but they want to steal your success away, your money. They're constantly harassed by enemy kings, who therefore never attain actual happiness. So this is recapitulation of material existence. And now to move forward towards the answer of the question. Therefore, tasmad, therefore, anyone who actually understands the material situation and that person actually desires happiness, not the so-called happiness that is available in the material world, which is another name for misery, which is one of the main points. Therefore, tasmad gurum prapadyeta. Therefore, understanding that, prapadita, one should take shelter of gurum, a spiritual master, gigyasur shreya uttamam, and from him inquire about shreya uttama. What is actual shreya? What is actually self-interest? Uttama, the topmost self-interest. And then into the qualification of such a person worthy of taking shelter of shabde pare chanishnatam. He's perfectly knowledgeable in shastra, the shabda in the Vedas, and pare, para, param, the supreme. Brahmani upasama asrayam, and he's fixed. Upasama asrayam, he's fixed, he's detached from material affairs. Gross, subtle, he's just not interested in the material world. He's giving Shreya Uttama because he's grabbed that, he's touched that, he's involved in that, he's absorbed in that, knowledgeable, perfectly knowledgeable in the Supreme and in the Vedas. So he's abstracted out the truth of the Vedas, and he's understands the Supreme. Here's a translation. Therefore, any person who seriously desires real happiness, so all those, the last section and these preliminary verses in this section are to dissipate our illusory hope that there is some situation in the material world that will provide either happiness, security, etc. And therefore, understanding that, what to do? And the first step is to take shelter here. Take shelter of him by initiation. So that's obviously not directly mentioned in the, but that's what it means to take shelter, although the verse doesn't directly say that. The qualifications of the bona fide guru is that he has realized the conclusions of the scriptures by deliberation and is able to convince others of these conclusions. Such great personalities who have taken shelter of the Supreme Godhead, leaving aside all material considerations, should be understood to be bona fide spiritual masters. We'll read some of, as you, one would imagine, there's quite a bit of purport here. We'll read the first paragraph and here and there. According to Srila Sridhar Swami, the word Shabde refers to the Vedic literature and Pade refers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The bona fide spiritual master must be Nishnatam, deeply experienced in authorized Vedic literatures and in practical understanding of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Without scriptural knowledge and practical realization of the Personality of Godhead, a so-called guru will be unable to dissipate the doubts of his disciples and therefore unable to execute the function of bringing the sincere student back home, back to Godhead. The symptoms of realized understanding of the Vedas and Krishna is upasamasrayam. In other words, the bona fide spiritual master is one who has retired from the glittering illusions of materialistic society, friendship, and love. He has withdrawn his consciousness from those wrong bank accounts, and he has placed everything in the hands and shelter, in the shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that is, he's fully surrendered. He's withdrawn, retired from the glittering illusions. This is from further down in the purport. It's a long commentary, so it's on page 222 if you have the book in front of you, at the bottom of the page. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, if a spiritual master cannot destroy his disciples' doubts by superior knowledge, the disciple will gradually become despondent in spiritual life. Because a bogus guru cannot actually give Krishna to the disciple according to the principles of rasova, jam, raso, prasya, means the higher taste, the disciple will again become attracted to material happiness, not having achieved the bliss of Krishna's association. Interesting topic and somewhat complicated. Such a weak disciple of a weak spiritual master will gradually become hopeless and discouraged in his attempt at self-realization and will again become fascinated by the temptations of illusion, such as woman, money, and so-called intellectually based and so-called intellectuality based on speculation and imagination. Further symptoms of the bona fide spiritual master are given in the Upadeshamrita, Vacho Vegam, Manasakrodha Vegam, Jiva Vegam, Udrapasta Vegam, Itan Vegan, Yo Vishaheta Diela, Savan Apimam, Pratavim Sashishyat. A sober person who can tolerate the urge to speak, the mind's demands, the action of anger and the urges of the tongue, belly and genitals is qualified to make disciples all over the world. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has stated, Upasamasrayam krodha lobha dyavashi bhutam. A bona fide spiritual master cannot be under the control of ordinary anger, greed and lust. According to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, one who has understood the futility of material existence can approach a bona fide spiritual master. In the two previous verses, the futility of earthly and heavenly sense gratification has been described. Now the natural conclusion is that one who has understood this should approach a bona fide spiritual master. And then at the end of the purport, according to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, even though one may have the good fortune to accept a bona fide, highly qualified guru, if one maintains a taste for fruitive activities or mental speculation, one's advancement will be checked. But if a serious student surrenders to a bona fide spiritual master, there is absolutely no impediment to the transmission of perfect knowledge and bliss in the devotional service of the Lord. So, if there are questions on that, we'll take them at the end. I think we should have time. And then, 22. So then, what next? Tatra Bhagavatam Dharmam. So again, Bhagavata, Bhagavat Dharma. So there, with the spiritual master, Bhagavatam Dharma, the science of devotional service, Shikshed. One should learn that. Guru Atma Daivata. He should learn, in the translation this is, he should learn the process of pure devotional service. Amayaya, without deceit. Anuvritya, by faithful service. Yai, Tushyet, Atmada, Hari. Tushyet, Atma, Dod, Hari. That one should perform his devotional service in an unduplicitous, undeceitful way, so that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is Atma, who is the soul of all souls, he will be inclined to give himself to such a devotee. Atmada means he gives himself. So this is after getting the instructions from a person who is qualified and realized and experienced enough to give the instructions. The second part of the relationship or of the process is described, that he should perform his devotional service based on those instructions in such a way, with such a mentality, with such a consciousness, that the Lord, who is Hari, who gives himself to his devotee, he will actually do that. And in this way, the process of bhakti yoga is completely different from the processes of karma yoga and jnana yoga, which are processes by which one can proceed by one's own power and strength. But here, the process is simply to perform devotional service in an unduplicitous way that the Supreme Lord is pleased. And then he, by his very nature, because he's called Atma Dohari, that he bestows himself upon such a sincere servant, such a sincere devotee, such a pure devotee. Pure devotee means anya vilasita sunyam, that there's not like Putana, who's doing her devotional service. Who's another one who did devotional service like Putana? Kamsa? No, not like, he didn't even bother disguising himself. Who was another one? Vatsasura was another one. Pralambasura. All Vraj became filled with them. Vatsasura, because Kamsa, he tried to understand, because Krishna was young at that time. This was before Vatsasura. Before Krishna, this is chapter 11 of the 10th canto, before Krishna started taking, just before he left Vrindavan, after he came to Vrindavan, but before he started taking out the cows, so he was still taking out the calves, and he was just a little boy, just 3-4 years old, so little, just this big. And Kamsa was becoming so fearful of this little boy, because he had killed Putana, he had killed the Shakatashura, he had killed Trinavarta, who were trusted messengers and demon friends of Kamsa. He was becoming afraid, so he thought he should be very clever. And he thought, who does Krishna love the most? And he asked his friends and spies about this Krishna, who is he close to? And the reply was, he loves the calves. So using the soft heart and love that Krishna has for the calves, Kamsa wanted to use that to kill Krishna. So he immediately called for Vatsasura, who took the form of a calf, also Vyomasura later on. But he took the form of a calf, and he entered into the group of calves a little bit late in the day, and Krishna immediately recognized him, that this is Vatsasura, this is a demon. Just see, he said to Balaram, do you recognize this calf over here? Balaram looked at him, said, no, he wasn't there in the morning. And Krishna said, just see how he's staring at us, and his eyes filled with hate and envy. Krishna said, I think he's a demon. Balaram said, yes, he's a demon. So Vatsasura was thinking that I'll just stay in the back of the herd of calves until Krishna gets used to me and trusts me. Then I'll grab him and Balaram and throw him on my shoulders and throw them in front of Kamsa. So Krishna started thinking, I'll get him, but let me just wait till he trusts me. So Krishna loves the calves so much. And don't ask why does he love calves and cows. Like, because this is his very nature. This is who Krishna is. This is his personality. This is his characteristic. He loves calves and cows so much. And they're lovable, but he loves them. So sometimes he would kiss the calves, causing Mother Yasoda, being his mother, a lot of anxiety. But he would massage their legs, and he would pet them and scratch them. Under their chin, he would pat them, and they loved Krishna so much. So he would massage their tired legs from walking on the ground of Braja, because they were so young. And then one by one, and then when he got to Vatsasura, grabbed his legs and didn't try to massage them at all. And Vatsasura was thinking, oh, he's coming close to me, he trusts me. And Krishna was thinking, he's letting me come close to him, he trusts me. And then he grabbed him and then he swung him around, because Krishna didn't want to get accused of killing a beloved, a calf. So as he was being swung around, Vatsasura lost his mystic ability to maintain that artificial form of a calf, and he assumed his real form, and then Krishna threw him into a tree and killed him. This is how some of the ways they kill demons: throw them, some whirl them around and throw them into a tree. Dhanukasura and his friends also killed him that way. So that's duplicitous conduct. But devotional service, for it to be effective, to bring the result, has to be unduplicitous. It has to be anya bilasita sunyam, jnana karma anavrita. No adulterations, nothing added, no artificial ingredients added, no alloys added, mixtures. So this is the Abhideya Tattva, is in its simplest way. It's pure. It's just acting for Krishna's pleasure. There is no deceit. And then, so the first thing is approach the qualified spiritual master, and then the disciple's qualification very much is this. And then Krishna, the third part of this equation, what really is described, and he's Atmada. He gives himself. How does he reciprocate? Is he some kind of a dictator who has some kind of emotional need to create everything in such a way that no one could be happy unless they surrender unto him? Because the demonic mentality thinks like this: that what kind of God is this? Why can't he make it so we're happy? If he's generous, and if he's so attractive, why does he make it so that we can't be happy in other way, in any other way than by surrendering to him? He has some problem or something, perhaps some emotional need. This is a thought that easily comes to the demonic mentality. Why can't he make it so the conditioned soul can be happy without him? And then he's so attractive that if we want to be with him, then we can be with him. So what's the problem? So this is the demonic mentality at work. What's the answer to that, by the way?
There's a hidden assumption in that question.
Yeah.
That our nature has been created by Krishna at some point of time, whereas the jiva is a part of the absolute.
Yeah, there you go with the essential point, that this is who we are. This is who we are. It's like saying, why can't water be fire or something? Why can't sugar be bitter? You know, God can do to understand who God is. That you can say he's unlimitedly powerful. He can do everything, but he can't. And like, can he make something so big that he can't lift it? And if he can't make something so big, he's not all powerful. And he can't lift it, he's not all powerful. So he's the God of he's not the God of nonsensical statements. You know, he can't. It's not that he can say he can make it. Doesn't mean he can do what can be done. What's in the power of the all powerful. But he doesn't mean he can do nonsense things that can't. Can he make something exist and non-exist at the same time, or something like that? You know, that's just words. Impossible. Just words. But there's another point also. So this is who we are. We are irrevocably his. This is who we are. This is our dharma, our nitya dharma, our sanatana dharma. That we are mama eva angsa. Krishna says that, that we are certainly and only his part and parcel. We're his amsa. And we should accept it. And the desire to be something other than what we are, Krishna's eternal servant, Because what we are is, to the sense of being what we are means ego, and the sense of we want to be what we're not is false ego. So that's why we're in the material world. But Krishna does give away, actually, of that, okay, you want to be happy without me, I'll tell you just how to do it. Here's the Vedas, here's, you live in the mode of goodness, and you perform unlimited piety and stuff, and you can be happy without me. So he allows that. Of course, there's, you have to eventually die, even Lord Brahma eventually dies. But he does give that even. He does give away that if you want to be happy without him, you can be. But it's not who we are. And it, even that kind of happiness will have some limitation. But we're being asked to accept who we are as Krishnas. We are Krishnas. And in the glory of, so he's not a dictator, because Atma Pajanta Vedant Bhakta Vatsalya, but he gives himself to his devotee. So he's not just there telling you what to do, but he's a person. He's a supreme person who, when you give yourself to him in a simple and unduplicitous way, he gives himself to you. So it's an actual relationship. A dictator is, you just give, and there's nothing in reciprocation. Your existence is meant for my pleasure. That's what the conditioned soul reacts against. But Krishna is not like that at all. When we take the mood, my existence is meant for your pleasure, dear Krishna, which is our natural consciousness, then he takes the mood, well, my existence is meant for your pleasure. So what can we, infinitesimal souls, actually, in fact, do for his pleasure? But look at it the other way, if you're talking about a good deal. What can the unlimited Supreme Personality of Godhead do for an insignificant soul for his pleasure? So who gets the better part of the arrangement in that sense? So therefore, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami Maharaj in fourth chapter of Adi Lila, he says that those who think that the enjoyment of the basically the Lord and the living entity are equal even, they do not understand my braja. Because it's so hard for us to accept the simple point that we are infinitesimal and insignificant. That is the potency of Maya, to give us that illusory understanding of ourself, making, and we think we're so important. But it is not hard to convince anyone else that we're infinitesimal and insignificant. It's hard to convince anyone else that we're anything but infinitesimal and insignificant. And it's obvious that we're infinitesimal and insignificant, because there's look how many living entities in this world exist. Humans, but not only humans, others, and we'll be crushed into powder in time, and no one will remember us, and in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 5,000 years, 10,000 years, 100,000 years. So we are insignificant and infinitesimal and inconsequential. This is the last thing a conditioned soul wants to hear, that he's inconsequential. What does inconsequential mean? Yeah, nothing you do makes any difference. Your existence is so insignificant that it doesn't mean anything. Like some little bug or something like that. Who cares? That's who we are. It's hard to accept, isn't it? False ego refuses to accept that. And you try to think like that intellectually, your mind will give you a kick. Give you a good kick. How dare you say that I'm... Because the mind's business is protection of the illusory sense of self. That's part of what it does. So this material consciousness, false ego consciousness, is challenged by this consciousness of devotional service. And we can't do it ourselves, but the result is that Krishna reciprocates by giving us the advancement that we long for by our simple, sincere service. Different kind of a process. The translation. Accepting the bona fide spiritual master as one's life and soul and worshipable deity, which is that verse, Bhaktyaikam Gurudeva Tatma. Was that in the second chapter or? Or does that come? Yeah, so we just heard that. This is, again, the process. Bhayam dvitiya, how to get free from this the material world, which is fearful and it's defined as dual. Accepting the bona fide spiritual master as one's life and soul and worshipable deity, the disciples should learn from him the process of pure devotional service. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, the soul of all souls, is inclined to give himself to his pure devotees. Therefore, the disciple should learn from the spiritual master to serve the Lord without duplicity and in such a faithful and favorable way that the Supreme Lord, being satisfied, will offer himself to the faithful disciple. Purport. According to Srila Sridhar Swami, the Lord's tendency to give himself to his pure devotee is demonstrated in the case of Bali Maharaj, who sacrificed his universal kingdom for the pleasure of Lord Vamanadeva. Lord Vamanadeva was so pleased by the selfless surrender of Bali Maharaj that the Lord became the doorman, like chokidar, in the palace of Bali, who was reinstalled as a great leader in the universe. So Krishna, in the form of Lord Vamanadeva, he took away everything from Bali, then insulted him, and wanted to demonstrate the depth of Bali Maharaj's surrender. Surrender means, I am yours. You can do whatever you want to me, with me. And Bali Maharaj was tested to the depth. He's a king, a kshatriya, warrior, and took away everything from him and then embarrassed him, humiliated him in front of everyone, his family members, Prahlad Maharaj, his relatives, wives, children, everyone humiliated, tied up, made the powerful king made a prisoner and couldn't do anything. And still, with his false ego slapped in that way, it was seen that he actually had no false ego. He said, anyway, I'm yours. Put your feet on my head. Okay. Whatever you like, I'm your servant. If somehow or another this is giving pleasure to you, okay. As the gopis, if this pleasure to you to get rid of your headache, okay, we'll go to hell. Sounds so wonderful. But this depth is not easily attainable, but when it is attainable by such simplicity and sincerity, can be done just like that in a half a moment. Kadvanga Maharaj surrendered. Bali Maharaj surrendered. Then Krishna becomes purchased. He reciprocates. Yayatama. You give yourself to him, he gives himself to you. Not in a mechanical way, but with devotion. So this is so wonderful. So Bali Maharaj is an example. Srila Jiva Goswami comments that the spiritual master is to be considered the Atma, or the very life of the disciple, since real life begins when one is initiated by a bona fide spiritual master, because he gives life. Although one may experience many seemingly wonderful or important events in a dream, one's real life begins when he wakes up. Similarly, since the spiritual master gives birth to the disciple by awakening him to spiritual life, a bona fide disciple understands that his spiritual master is the very basis of his life. According to Srila Jiva Goswami, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the reservoir of all pleasure, and thus the Lord's giving himself to a pure devotee indicates that such a devotee becomes immersed in the highest possible ecstasy. In this connection, there is the following Shruti mantra: Ananda Dhimani Dhimani Bhutani Jayante. Indeed, it is from the All Blissful Supreme that all these creatures have come into being. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has further pointed out that when the Lord bestows his own self upon a pure devotee, such a fortunate devotee can actually see the Lord, touch him, and directly engage in his service. So there are many interesting questions and points that can be asked and spoken of here. But we'll move on, and I'll stop fairly soon, though, so we can leave time for questions. And if we go forward, then tomorrow's class shouldn't be overly long. 33. These verses, I was thinking of these as and it's going to be a definition of the whole of what devotional what it means to be fully engaged in devotional service. A sincere sarvato manaso asangam. Everywhere the mind should dissociate, asangam, be detached. I'll read the translation, it's easy. A sincere disciple should learn to dissociate the mind from everything material and positively cultivate association with his spiritual master and other saintly devotees. He should be merciful to those in an inferior position to him, cultivate friendship with those on an equal level, and meekly serve those in a higher spiritual position. Thus he should learn to deal properly with all living beings. So what is that a paraphrasing of, practically speaking, of the Madhyam devotee from the previous chapter? So this is a sincere disciple should quickly come to the Madhyam platform. Text 23. So this is what it means to progress in the process of devotional service. Dissociate the mind from everything material. So notice the word sincere in there, because you have to really be sincerely convinced that the material world is a hopeless place for happiness, and become positively associated the mind. And this is also the same thing as mentioned in Kapila Muni's teachings, that the mind must become attached. It will attach to something. So when it dissociates from material things and attaches itself to the sadhus, then in Kapila Muni they give the definition of a sadhuva, sadhuva bhushanam. And then what happens when the association with sadhus is there? Is satam prasangam mamavirya samvido. Then hear shastra. And hear shastra about sambandha abhideya prayojana, all the process about knowledge, the process, and what the goal is, because one must have his mind fixed on the goal. Otherwise, one loses his enthusiasm for the process. Unless one knows what the goal is and feels like he's making progress. So this is also in the Because again, it's based on desire. So therefore, in the Chaturstoki Bhagavatam verses, the third verse describes the Prayojana. How Krishna is in everything and everywhere. He's the one, and through prema he comes. It describes prema. And then the fourth one, etidaveva gigyasura, that you can find it everywhere. Because unless the desire is there, there's no taking up of the abhideya, of the process with strength. So the desire has to be strong if we are to take up the process with strength and overcome all the obstacles of material existence. So that's where the sincerity comes in too. But it's not only sincerity, one needs knowledge, and one needs to be to know. To sincerity is the attunement of one's desires to the shastric knowledge and the ability to actually do that, to dissociate the mind from everything materially and positively. This is surrender also. Accept that which is favorable, reject that which is unfavorable. So this, the same thing is being described from in so many shastras and parts of Bhagavatam and Upadeshamrita and different places, but they're being described from somewhat different angles. But it's the same process. So dissociate from matter, material desires. Associate one's mind, positively cultivating association and other saintly devotees, because in proper association, then mama virya samvido, then the topics about Krishna katha will have potency. And then how to deal with other people are described. Again, be merciful to those in a lesser position, friendly with those on an equal level, meekly serve those, humbly serve those in a higher spiritual position, and deal properly with all living entities in a favorable way. So this is what Maharaj Prickett also desired when he was about to leave this world. He asked that for the blessings, part of the blessings he asked from the great sages. He asked for the ability to act in a friendly way towards all living entities, appropriate and friendly way to all living entities. So here's the blueprint for that. So we'll read, this is also another really long purport. The purports are quite long and wonderful. But we'll just read a small part of it. This is on page 229, after Tasmad Guru Prapadyita Gigyasura Shreya Uttama. So any person who seriously desires real happiness must seek a bona fide spiritual master and take shelter of him by initiation. The qualification of the bona fide guru is that he has realized the conclusions of the scriptures by deliberation, and he's able to convince others of these conclusions. We've just heard this verse. Such great personalities who have taken shelter of the Supreme Godhead, leaving aside all material considerations, should be understood to be bona fide spiritual masters. On the other hand, one should avoid the association of a materialistic person, even if such a person is outwardly chanting the holy names of Krishna. Srila Rupa Goswami has advised in this respect, Krishna iti asyagiritam manasadriyata dikshasti chet patanatavis chabhajantamisham sasursaya bhajana vigyanananyamanya nindati sanya ridamipsita sangalabhya. One may mentally offer respect to any living entity who is chanting the holy name of Krishna, but one should avoid intimate association with materialistic persons, especially those attached to sex enjoyment. Tamo dharam yoshita sangi sangam. If one associates with a sensuous person who is attached to the company of women, or vice versa, by such association one will surely go to hell. But if a materialistic person approaches a pure devotee with a sincere desire to hear from him about spiritual improvement, that first-class devotee may mercifully give his association, provided the purpose of such a meeting is advancement in devotional service of Krishna. By such association, even a materialistic person can gradually become a pure devotee of Krishna. If an advanced devotee is not able to engage a materialistic person in the devotional service of Krishna, such association is strictly forbidden. One cannot be liberated without association, verse from the Garuda Purana, with a pure devotee of the Lord. And unless one shows mercy to those in an inferior position, one's life will be superficial. To serve the spiritual master, the disciple should learn cleanliness, austerity, tolerance, silence, study of Vedic knowledge, simplicity, celibacy, nonviolence, inequanimity in the face of material duality such as heat and cold, happiness and distress. So remember that the question was, how can even a foolish, a materialistic person? So I had the fortune of once saying to Prabhupada, Prabhupada, my only qualification is that I'm a fool. And at such a silly and superficial comment, he replied, yes, but you should not remain a fool. So we can't remain foolish and materialistic and quickly traverse the path to Krishna. So here in the purport here, there's but yet there's another side of that point too, and we'll get to that. I'd like to get to it today. But here's some of the terms that are described here, are defined. The word arjavam, this is on page 235 of the qualities that's required. Notice that these aren't directly bhakti. These would be considered in the terms of Jiva Goswami. This is Sangha Siddha Bhakti. These are useful in devotional service. Cleanliness, austerity, tolerance, silence, study of Vedic knowledge, simplicity, celibacy, nonviolence, equanimity in the face of material dualities such as heat and cold, happiness and distress. But they're not potent as devotional items themselves, because these are almost borrowed from the path of jnanamarg. But in devotional service, these qualities can be quite useful. But in and of themselves, they are not potent in devotional service, such as differentiated from different practices, devotional practices, or such as hearing and chanting about Krishna, remembering Krishna itself, which have inherent potency of the potency of Krishna directly in them. So this type of instruction of devotional service are just to facilitate the actual potent processes of devotional service. So there's some definitions of them in the purport by quoting Sridhar Swami. Swachatam, clarity, transparency, means straightforwardness. Unless one is in pure consciousness, he will adopt many crooked means. Straightforwardness does not indicate that one should insult others in the name of honesty, especially the other devotees. Prabhu, I want to be honest with you. I hate you, and I think you deserve to die immediately. I was being honest. But that's not what straightforwardness is. But it should speak the humble truth. The word brahmacharyam or celibacy indicates either renouncing completely the association of women, or on the other side of men, or strictly following the Vedic principles of household life, which regulate sex life for the purpose of procreating saintly children. Ahimsa indicates that one should not commit violence against any living entity. Unless one is aware of the subtle laws of karma, by which a living being enjoys and suffers, one cannot actually practice ahimsa or nonviolence. So there's more of these type of explanations here, but I want to move on. One should practice meditation, this is 25, by constantly seeing oneself to be an eternal, cognizant, conscious spirit soul, and seeing the Lord to be the absolute controller of everything. To increase one's meditation, one should live in a secluded place. So again, here he's moving to very difficult to practice, not directly sarup siddha bhakti items, not directly potent bhakti items, but these can be used to facilitate the potent items of bhakti. To increase one's meditation, the point is to increase one's meditation. What does meditation mean? Means absorption. The consciousness is absorbed in Krishna, thoughts of Krishna, and service to Krishna even, more superior to just meditation. To increase one's meditation, one should live in a secluded place and give up false attachment to one's home and household paraphernalia. Giving up the decorations of the temporary material body, one should dress himself with scraps of cloth found in rejected places or the bark of trees. Well, at least he didn't say the bark of dogs. Dress oneself with the bark of dogs. Could be more austere. In this way, one should learn to be satisfied in any material situation. So the point being here is that one should become materially attached to dissociate oneself from all the material desires that plague our consciousness, that cause us to be absorbed in material life, in material consciousness. So these items, in both the previous verse and this verse, are items to assist with the principle of becoming attached and absorbed in Krishna consciousness. So in the purport here, very nice explanation of how to practically apply these principles and why they're necessary. In Kali Yuga, the conditioned souls are extremely attached to material sense gratification, and extreme austerities are not appreciated, but instead considered abominable denials of the flesh. Of course, austerity is required for spiritual advancement, but the practical example set by Srila Prabhupada in successfully spreading the Krishna conscious movement was that all material things should be used to attract people to Krishna consciousness. Therefore, Vaishnavas may at times adopt ordinary dress to serve the higher principle of distributing Krishna consciousness, because it's the consciousness. We want to make our consciousness fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness. Krishna bhakti rasita bhavato mati. We want to be, so this detachment from the realm of matter is required for that purpose. And it's not that we can just say, oh, this isn't necessary either, and then remain, have utility as the principle. Yes, everything, we can use everything in Krishna's service, but yet we have to remember that purity is the force, the purity or the fully sincere desire to please Krishna is the force that gives potency to utility as the principle. And if in the name of utility as the principle that everything can be used in Krishna's service, we neglect the sincere and pure purpose of actually using it in Krishna's service, we'll just utilize everything in our own service, which won't help us at all. And that's the point, that it's in our benefit to dissociate ourselves from material consciousness, from trying to enjoy the material world, from having material desires. And it's in our benefit to become absorbed fully in thoughts of Krishna and Krishna's service. Because it's again those desires that will carry us to where, to our natural and eternal home in relationship with Krishna. So there's more instructions. I wanted to get up to the 27th and 28th verse, but that would be pushing too much. There's so many important instructions, and we have to some degree we have to extrapolate the principles behind some of them, and some very direct. Okay, thank you. Any questions or comments? So we got up to 20, we completed to some degree at least 25. And tomorrow we'll start with 26 and complete up to 40. Any questions or comments?
First, Bhaj Bihari.
In the beginning, we were talking about love verses about the three modes of material nature.
In the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, earlier today.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm trying to understand them a little bit more because they're also inert matter. Right.
But they're also empowered.
Yeah.
But that's part of them. See, they have their forces, and then there's they turn into the ingredients of material nature too. This is described in the third canto, how false ego combines with the mode of goodness, turns into one set of items, including the mind. False ego in the mode of passion, and combines with the mode of passion, and turns into other things. And false ego combines with the mode of goodness, turns into the sense objects, the senses, and the gross material elements. But it's the modes of material nature, the same modes that control us, are in that sense not different from the ingredients of the universe as well. Is that...
The elements energize, like the false ego energizes the modes, like the soul energizes our body.
But this is all under the energizing ingredient. See, what happens is the Lord glances, Mahavishnu glances at the material, at the pradhan, the subtle material nature, which is, it's sagun brahman. It's brahman with some qualities. So it's material, and it's different from brahman, which is nirgun brahman, which has no material qualities. But it's fine, it's subtle, it's like goodness. But he injects in that the living entities with their karma. So everything is in this soup, unmanifested soup of material nature. But when you throw the living entities with their karma and kala shakti, time in there, it stirs it up and things begin to manifest. So it's coming, maya dakshen, it's coming under the glance of the Lord, it's coming by his potency, but the immediate cause is the living entities in their karma, but under the supervision of the Lord. So it's the living entities and their desires that stir things up, but ultimately it's the Lord's glance, or the Lord who stirs it up, and the glance is the Shambhu, or Sarashiva, like that.
And then that's the Mahatattva.
Then it turns into the Mahatattva when things begin to manifest.
So the modes, they affect only living entities or also inert matter?
Well, you mean is this in the mode, in a mode?
Well, maybe, or because it's the color, you know, like different colors are in modes, so that's color white. So is that in a mode?
Well, everything, all of matter is ultimately in the mode of ignorance, because it's coming from the mode of ignorance. False ego combined with the mode of ignorance produces all the senses, the sense objects, and the gross matter, material equivalent that carries that. It's all from ignorance. What, the modes of nature and the material? This is their land. This is their realm, and that's Mahamaya, the realm of Mahamaya. and she's presided over by Durga Devi. This is the land of Durga Devi. And she has many weapons, but she's a reflection of the spiritual world, the Yogamaya in the spiritual world. So everything is ultimately coming in that realm, coming from Srimati Radharani, Lakshmi Devi and Srimati Radharani. And Durga means fort or prison, or very difficult to get out.
I have one technical question and one comment.
Yes.
The technical question is about 1.3.12, where Rama leaves his universal body.
Yeah, yeah.
So is that universal body the same as Viratrupa, describing the second country, is sharing it with the super soul?
That's my understanding.
Is the soul and...
He's the soul. And Lord Kiradakshaya Vishnu is the super soul. Different from Garbhadakshaya Vishnu is in there, but like the universal form is Brahma's like subtle body. It's like his body, but it's subtle. That's my understanding. And but without Krishna and without Vishnu entering it, it doesn't work. So that's the experience that you have in the third canto, right? When the demigods pray for the, because everything is there. After Brahma creates everything, he's the creator of it. He's like the soul of it, but nothing is working. And then Vishnu enters, and okay, now the universal body starts working. So that's the philosophical message behind that, that you can even have the soul in the universe or in this body, and it's necessary but insufficient. You need the super soul, you need the Lord to energize everything for his, because everything is ultimately resting on his potency.
Could be even, there is some more technical information. The third canto, Vishishan says there are three Brahmas. One is Hiranyagarbha, one is...
The four-headed Brahma.
Four-headed Brahma, and one is the universal form, as I understand, by Radha.
Yeah.
This one here. And there are two universal forms, one is gross, one is subtle. So the Vairaja, as far as I understand, is this subtle, and the gross is just the plants.
And maybe the gross manifestation. That, yeah. Yeah, this, it's some of it, so not, I could say some of it is beyond me, but I could say ultimately all of it is beyond me. But yeah, it's good to know these things because people read and ask questions too. So there's So Brahma's gross body is the universe, basically. And he, the Brahma, four-headed Brahma, is the soul. He's the manifestation of that. But Brahma's body isn't, it's not gross like our bodies are gross either, so. Yeah, it's subtle.
Are you saying that Brahma's body is the Viratrupa? So what was Arjuna's point in proving to the future of the world that if somebody wants to prove they're Krishna, they have to show the universal form?
Well, but Arjuna also had to have his consciousness brought down to a lower level to see that from his higher level. Because Krishna can manifest that, because his part is, his part is Baladev, and Baladev Shankarshan, and Shankarshan, or the Mahashankarshan, then Mahavishnu, and then Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. So a part of a part of a part of Krishna is manifesting Brahma and the entirety of the universe.
Oh, So just as
so to be God, you have to be able to do at least that, manifest the universe, what to manifest spiritual pastimes in Goloka Vrindavan. You have to do something extraordinary. That's the point Prabhupada makes in the purport. It's easy to say, I'm God, we're all God. But to do something extraordinary is not so easy. Extraordinary.
You know, so just as you mentioned, in the third canto, Brahma tried, but he couldn't without Krishna. All the demigods tried, but they couldn't manifest without Krishna.
I always thought of the universal form as like the, as described in the third canto, it's like the documentation, the blueprint of the universe, the subtle documentation of the universe. So Brahma is the heart of that, the heart and soul of that. And he can read that. And from that subtle, the gross is manifested. That's the saga, the visarga. So the subtle one is created by the Lord, by Krishna, and the secondary creation is created by Brahma. The gross manifestation based on the subtle. Yeah.
A little comment. Prabhupada subtly praises Nimi in his first verse, not in the first verse, when he says, Tasmat Guru Prapadyata Jigyasu Shreya Uttamam. The Bhagavad Dharma starts with asking about the ultimate good. And that was actually the first question that Nimi asked to the Navayagandhas. He kind of subtly praises him that this is, you're already doing this, you're asking about the Atyantikamsham, the ultimate good.
Nice. That means he's come to that realization.
And he also confirms that you're probably asking this for heaven.
Yes, yes. Nice. That brings that into perspective. Nice. Did you have a...
This morning we spoke about the symptoms of the vision of a Mahabharata, and I was just reading about the Bhagavad Gita. 6:30 is describing the vision of a Mahabharata, and in the purpose of the Bhagavata writes, at the end, at this stage, Lord Krishna never disappears from the sight of the devotee, nor does the devotee ever lose sight of the Lord. So here it seems that Krishna appears before the devotee, and therefore he has this vision. But I think that this is not a perspective of...
But when you're talking about a high spiritual level, there's no difference. Like prema, premanjana charita bhakti vilochanena, it's the prem, his vision causes Krishna he's actually manifest there. So, again, would you like to speak more on that point?
No, I just wanted to understand that it's a two-way, there is a
recitation
of Krishna,
yeah,
which is going together with the vision.
Also nice. Yes?
Just mentioning that shloka about Mahabharata, Sri Vishwanath points out that it doesn't mean that every moment one is visualizing the form of Krishna. Rather, it means that one has reached the exalted platform of devotional service in which he is fit to see, or is capable of seeing Krishna's form. It's 148. So in other words, it doesn't mean that always only sees Krishna, but he's capable of seeing Krishna, according to Sri Vishwanath here.
Yeah. So it's not like he sees... He doesn't just see the form of Krishna everywhere. Like he doesn't. In other words, he can still practically deal in the material world if his consciousness isn't in an ecstatic state where he's just seeing Krishna or separate from Krishna.
Actually, he quotes further the Bhagavad Gita, same Bhagavad Gita verse.
6:30.
Yeah, it's coming right after. It's like lusty man seeing. lusty man thinking that, that the world is full of beautiful women.
Yeah.
So it's the same Imam Pashati Sava. So in other words, it's a greed producing this woman.
And just like in the material world, you, because I was trying to use the material world as an example to help us understand something that is the consciousness of such an exalted soul, which is basically ununderstandable to us. So the mother seeing her shoes, she sees her child in that, but she's seeing the child in the mind, and it doesn't manifest necessarily the child actually being there. But Krishna, sometimes when one sees Krishna in something, he can manifest, or he can leave one in the state of separation, which is not very different from him manifesting, because you're thinking about him, and Krishna is no different from the thought about him also.
Or you're filled with affection.
Because of the affection. Because affection with Krishna, it's just like in the Venugita, where the gopis are feeling separation from Krishna, but the acharyas sometimes describe that he's actually appearing before them. So he's appearing before them, then you'd think, well, then why are they feeling separation? But it's because of their separation. And so it's this type of spiritual consciousness is obviously hard for the material intelligence to penetrate. But we can understand that it's so wonderful. And for someone who's so surrendered to Krishna, that he's always with Krishna in that consciousness, either in separation or in meeting, that he, you know, it's ecstatic. It's the spiritual realm. He's always there with Krishna, one way or another. It's the affection that Krishna can't keep away from, that type of affection, but how he manifests it.
I was meditating on that, and if one is at the Brahma Buddha platform or Nishtha, then Nashoshtana Kanshati, there is no disturbance of the mind. So if one desires to think of Krishna, one can think of Krishna. But then there is a desire, because unfortunately, even those who are near to that platform, they do not always desire to think of Krishna, to see everything.
You're talking about like impersonalists or?
Impersonalists, yeah. And we also with devotees who have not reached that platform, but they think sometimes of Krishna, but then they forget. So the thing is that, because you spoke it about desire is the basis. So the pure devotee, his desire is so strong that.
But there's also different levels of pure devotees. But at some point, if one wants to be with Krishna, Goloka Vrindavan, if that desire is a flame in his heart, he will be there, because Krishna will reciprocate fully with that. But that platform is rare, because Krishna doesn't give it. It's not, again, going back to the point that it's not something that from now on I'm always going to think of Krishna and be fixed in this, and always think of Krishna. It comes by a gift of grace, by Krishna's appreciating the simple, sincere service that the devotee is doing. The simple, sincere service may be simple, sincere service that Prabhupada did, which was like saving the whole world, or it may be simply sweeping before Lord Jagannath or the temple room. But if it's actually done for the pleasure of Krishna, Krishna reciprocates, and he will even give himself. He's such a Lord and Master, because after all, he doesn't need anything. So what is his reciprocation? Is that he makes the flame burn brighter. And how does he do that? Well, that's he does it in some way or another, either by appearing before the devotee and then disappearing. And when you have, and when you catch a glimpse of something and that you really want, and then it disappears again, it makes, like he did with Narada Muni. Look what he did to Narada Muni. He said, you know, Kashayanam, you know, because you have some impurity like that. But then Narada Muni, after that point, he just lost all attachment to anything other than being with the Lord again, and he engaged always in hearing and chanting and hearing and chanting. He wandered, but he just didn't care for anyone. And that comes up. He was just became fully absorbed in that energy of thinking about Krishna until the desire was so mature in him to be with Krishna, and then when he died, the body dropped instantaneously, his spiritual body blossomed. So he was the, Narada Muni is really, is our acharya in this, because his life is an exemplar, and it's presented as an exemplary going through the stages. But he went through them quite rapidly, but still how to what's supposed to happen is exemplified there. But we can't. We don't want to be distracted. The point being that we don't want to be distracted by the material realm. That's the most essential point. And then, quite naturally, if we follow the process, as we've heard it from Srila Prabhupada, follow the process, chant properly with the mind focused on the holy names, without offenses, with increasing attachment, then it will work. But the Daivamidrisam, because we commit offenses, we don't get the result rapidly. And then we should take the responsibility for that and then become humble. And then by humility, we can, our desire to take shelter and to please, and our dependence increases. So it's a process of continuously giving and taking and giving, you know, and going through a spiritual life and coming to the conclusions. It's a maturation. It's an evolution of consciousness.
I have a question. Thank you.
Yeah. Hare Krishna. Yes, Prabhu.
There's another example of Madhavendra Puri. Madhavendra Puri, when he went to Dhamara temple, there's a Gopinath temple. In Gopinath temple, it's very famous that they distribute a kheer, a special kheer that's called Amrit Keli kheer. It's very tasty. And the 12 pots.
Do you have any for us, Ma Brajanam, now that you've brought this topic up? Oh, probably.
So, in the temple, 12 pots of kheer will be brought, and there'll be line for getting prasadam. And Madhavendra Puri, he also got interested in taking prasadam of Amar Keli kheer. But then he said, I shouldn't do that. I shouldn't stand in line. I'm sannyasi. So he left without taking kheer. And later on, after the temple was closed, then Gopinath came in the dream of Pujari. There's a devotee of my devotee, he didn't get kheer. And out of 12 pots, one pot I have hidden under my pitambar. So take that pot and give it to Madhavendra Puri. And his father said that Madhavendra Puri is in such and such place and he's doing kirtan, just go and find him and give this kheer to him. So this Pujari took this pot, and Madhavendra Puri was so happy to see that kheer. Not only he ate the whole kheer, he took the pot, broke into pieces, and he will take a small piece of that pot every day with the prasadam. So Lord fulfilled the desire. He knew what he wants, and he fulfilled his desire.
Connected a little bit, not that to the other discussion. Trying to understand better the You were talking about the Avideya and Prayojana and the connection between the two. And you were saying nicely how that without clearly being fixed on the goal, then the Avideya kind of loses its relevance. But like in material life, or materially trying to achieve a goal, you often find, you know, people sometimes say that they don't like take time to smell the roses, you know, that they're so fixed on the goal that they kind of like the process goes to the wayside. And even you sometimes say that you're a process person and that process is so important. So is there any connection between that kind of thing in material life and what we're trying to practice? Can we kind of get, I don't know, so fixed on the goal that we don't perform the Abhideya properly? Or
sure. But that, because one has to know the Abhideya, for sure, and one could try and do it all himself. You know, make sure I'm going to get my prema bhakti, and this is what I'm going to do, and I'm just going to do it. But actually, it's a gift and it's grace, and we can lose simplicity. But you can't go wrong in the sense that when the desire is strong and sincere, the Krishna, he helps you with the process. So he'll teach in one way or another, in his own way, that the process is performed properly. Did you want to add?
Well, that's good enough. I'll think about more, but I just...
But you still have to perform the Abhideya part properly. Because the desire is there until you're on it. Yeah, and it is also it could be different according to the level of advancement too. Because really it can't really burn brightly, the desire, until we're more advanced. So sometimes we can artificially try to make it burn more brightly, but the modes of material nature will catch us if we try to do that. So, and in each case, we're supposed to be under higher guidance, which is really the answer to that. That everything should be done under guidance.
Is there any chance of the Abhideya itself becoming Niyamagraha if we're not fixed on the goal? If we don't have enough conception of what it means?
Yeah, we can mess up anything if we try hard enough. I mean, but that's why we're supposed to read the book from the beginning to the end, so we get all the different pieces. Yeah, and it's you know, the path of Krishna consciousness is a tricky path.
So is that what's happening? Like, if we're kind of going through the, you know, we're just kind of going through the routine of Krishna consciousness, even following.
And it becomes mechanical.
Yeah.
But it's not meant to be mechanical. I mean, there's so much instruction. When people start wrestling, it means it's time to end.
Okay, though. I know what
time. Yeah, but no, it's best that I end it too, usually, because actually, but but if we actually are sincere, even if sincerely trying, it's natural for us without so much guidance to make mistakes. But if we're sincerely trying, Krishna helps. So we're not alone on the path either. And we should keep in the association of devotees too. And we should have good friends, and we should part of the process is to have four different types of association, not just three or not just two. And we should have four types of association. So that, you know, it's always a balance. And keeping life in balance isn't easy, our spiritual life. So, you know, we want to, because balance, what's balanced at one time isn't necessarily balanced at another time. In other words, what we need to keep in balance today might be different than what we needed 6 months ago or 2 years ago. So the balance means that you have to be checking to see if you're balanced and what you need at the moment. So do I need more of this or do I need more of that? And then, and you know, we ask trusted friends and seniors, etc. Okay, last question. Some of us are getting old, some of us are old, and some, but all of us are getting older. Yeah. Well, but take the, instead of talking about that point, talk about the point that that it's really the consciousness that's important, because I could say I'm getting older and therefore I have to take care of my body because I'm really afraid of it falling apart too quickly, and because it's my body after all. Or we could be thinking that, you know, I have more service to do and let me keep the body for as long as it's practical so I can continue to perform my service. Or we could be thinking the first way but telling everyone the second way. You follow what I mean? But wait, this, it depends often what our service is and what our service is. So what my point was is, if you get your consciousness right, the center right, then how to practically apply the principles will be more correct. But if we try to get the what should I do, the external, the practical right, without getting the consciousness right, we'll most likely act incorrectly, even if we're acting correctly. And also, yeah, if we're acting externally correctly even, we may be acting internally incorrectly. So we want to try that thought and also confirm it with trusted friends and things like that. And also we may not be able to act on an ideal platform. And also, but you're saying, let me try to act on an ideal platform because it's falling apart. Sounds like you need someone to advise you what to do. That's poverty.
Well, things fall apart and disintegrate, which is the inevitable force of time. You try to focus on what your purpose of life is, and you find that you have to make adjustments here and there. And whatever adjustments it takes to remain slightly functional.
Focused on the
functional.
Yeah, if you keep the focus on what you want, right, that will align up your practical decisions.
Someone makes some path for you so that you can carry on in some way.
Or not carry on in some way.
Or if you can't carry on, that's what you're done, and you just have to adjust to it. That's all.
There's the voice of experience. And ultimately, what to do? It comes down to, you know, here we are, you know, and if you try your best, it may not help anyway. So ultimately, okay. That's one thing he said one time. That's what he said one time. But I don't know the particular circumstances he said that. He obviously, when people are actually starting to leave, that's way past the rustling stages, isn't it? Everyone's getting so hungry. Okay, I'm not going to answer your question anymore. Bhagavatam ki jai, Shri Prabhupada ki jai.